I'm living. All the advice been tipped in. Gave me that grip, no slipping. Salut, ici Matt Track, vous écoutez CKUT 90,3 FM.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's Community News Program, Off the Hour. Today is Friday, December 31st, or New Year's Eve. My name is Brian Jefferson, and I'll be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyukaaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Time.
C is for
cauliflower,
confusion, creation,
pickle, K sore,
kitten,
camp,
seat, wait, fan roof, say, U, unbearable,
U is for underground,
oh, yeah,
umbrella,
T, trite,
tremendous,
torment,
tire,
C, K,
I can't think of a U one,
T,
F is for famous,
fun, fumble, M is for Montreal.
It's time to make an appointment for your booster dose against COVID-19. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence plan for your area and book your appointment online. To continue protecting yourself against COVID-19 and its variants, get a booster dose and keep following distancing measures, wearing a mask, and washing your hands. The booster dose, the best way to stay protected longer. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
First, news. Premier François Legault announced Thursday that Quebec is reintroducing a curfew from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. The province is also implementing other restrictions to contain the spread of the Omicron variant. Restaurants will be closed except for takeout. Non-essential businesses will be closed on Sundays. Schools will not reopen until January 17th. Places of worship will be closed except for funerals. Indoor gatherings of more than one household bubble are forbidden. These restrictions will be in place as of today at 5 p.m. And Quebec unveiled a plan to allow COVID-positive healthcare workers who are asymptomatic to return to work. This plan is due to staffing shortages caused by an increase in hospitalizations. Health unions across the province have denounced the plan. And Montreal requisitioned two downtown hotels to accommodate homeless individuals. Homeless shelters are facing a lack of beds and staffing shortages, and around 20 are experiencing COVID outbreaks. There are an estimated 3,100 homeless individuals in Montreal and only 1,400 beds in shelters. And a federal prison in the Laurentian Mountains has reported COVID infections among 4 inmates and 15 employees. This prison, the La Macasa Institute, is currently prohibiting visitors. There were 88 new COVID cases among federal inmates this week. And Montrealer and Canto pop star Denise Ho was released on bail in Hong Kong after being jailed for 36 hours with 6 journalists, all connected to a pro-democracy news outlet. Police accused him of a, quote, conspiracy to publish seditious material, end quote. Ho was born in Hong Kong but grew up in Montreal and credits the city as an inspiration for her art and activism.
CKUT
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5 p.m., and my name is Brian Jefferson. This season, we've been sharing the air with creators that we think that you might want to hear from, and we'll do the same today. We're sharing the hour with Time Talks Podcast from the Channel Zero Network. In this episode, they talk to the author and scholar, Dr. Teresa Warburton, about literature, nationalism, and more. We'll bring you back at the top of the hour with some news that you can use.
Welcome to episode 45 of the Time Talks podcast, part of the Channel Zero Network. This month, I had the pleasure of speaking to Dr. Teresa Warburton. She's a scholar who focuses on the intersections of literature and social movements. Dr. Warburton is co-editor of Shapes of Native Nonfiction, Collected Essays by Contemporary Writers with Alyssa Washuda. Dr. Warburton's latest book is Other Worlds Here, Honoring Native Women's Writing in Contemporary Anarchist Movement. In this episode, Teresa speaks on collaboration, literature, nationalism, and discussions on contemporary anarchism. Thank you to Awareness for the music, and here's a jingle from a fellow Channel Zero Network member.
Silver Threads, Still Walking, Still Waking is co-hosted by me, Carla Bergman.
And me, Eleanor Goldfield. This is where we interview long-term organizers and radicals about their watershed moments, what they've learned along the way, and how they maintain their hope on this path. Dreaming and building emergent worlds for a present and future anchored in justice and freedom for all.
Because there are forks in the road, but they all lead us home to the fight, to the build.
In your book that you moved from Colorado to Massachusetts as a kid, and you mentioned in your book how Massachusetts is one of the first indigenous words you knew. I was wondering, can you explain a moment or a part of a process when you started to see through the propaganda of colonial society and started questioning these power structures?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think that I didn't really have a sense of that sort of seeing through things until I got a little bit older. And that, like, I'm thinking about in high school, just like learning about some of the history of the region in Massachusetts and thinking about, well, that history doesn't sort of line up with itself, you know, like some of the narratives of Thanksgiving. I think probably learning about the sort of pushback against the holiday of Thanksgiving, you know, the National Day of Mourning that they do in Plymouth, the American Indians of New England put on, was one of the first times that I sort of learned to question the stories that are told. And that's how I really think of it, as like the narratives that were told about the United States and sort of how those stories get perpetuated and what values get perpetuated through them, that there were a lot of times that I started hearing other stories that had different values. And that, I think, made me sort of question a lot of the stories I'd been told.
So it started kind of breaking those narratives apart. And yeah, definitely being in Massachusetts with the day of mourning that they do.
Uh-huh.
Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. And just thinking about, like, I think a lot of my sort of political education started happening through punk music when I was young. And so a lot of the narratives that, you know, punks talked about were a lot different than, you know, narratives about the United States just in general. What was it as a country were a lot of different, they were just very different narratives than I had been told. And that was a big learning process for me.
Yeah. And then music is just such an amazing conveyor of information and knowledge. And I really liked the hardcore quote you mentioned in the end of your book too, on how if it can hold me, it can hold all of us. And really the powerful use of that term. And maybe you could add on to that. And also, how did you or when did you start becoming familiar with anarchism or anarchy?
I think, you know, those two things are connected for me, because music was so much the first thing that I really became, even if it wasn't sort of connecting me to anarchism sort of proper, like introducing me to, you know, Kropotkin or Bakunin, it was introducing me to the sort of models of anarchism that I came to recognize later. So like just being in punk communities where people would do like benefit shows if something happened, like to a community member, or if something was going on in their community, like doing benefit shows as a form of mutual aid, like seeing that play out, or seeing consensus-based decision-making in bands, like as just basic premises that or values that I was taught like in those spaces. And even though I might not, I think I didn't quite recognize them as anarchism at the time, like it wasn't necessarily expressed that way. It's what I've come to understand as like anarchist practices. And that that was a way that I learned how to just sort of be with other people in good ways. And that's what I really think about anarchism being on its most basic level is, you know, how do we exist with each other in the in good ways that benefit all of us. And that was something I learned from those sort of music communities, and also just the a lot of the really politically oriented music that I was into at that time and still am into, I think, like taught me a lot about anarchism, that just introduced me to this idea that there was a thing called anarchism, and it was something that was like accessible to me and not something that was like scary or out there, but it was something that was in here that I could be part of.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Yeah, that's my favorite type of anarchism too, like a little a anarchism of just ways that it shows up in. You're already immersed in it, and it's not something that's so rigid or something else that would become more activist-y, I guess.
Yeah, that's really important to me. Like the idea that we need to have, you know, I think there needs to be some idea of what anarchism is, but that we can't be so rigid that we end up sort of pushing a lot of people out.
My next question is if you could speak about the power of collaborating on writing or even collective writing. I love the story of when you met Elisa Wishuda and you were both wearing the same clothes and the book you both edited, Shapes of Native Nonfiction, collected essays by contemporary writers, and how you used the basket as a structure or form for the book.
Yeah, I mean, collaboration was so, I think, wonderful to have that book come out before my solo book, because the collaboration was really where so much of that book took shape. Like the shape of that book was really from Alyssa and I's relationship, I think. And that I think of it like it really is a commitment to a lifetime of working together. And doing that collaboration together was a project where we had to learn a lot about how, you know, just thinking about labor, like how to divide up labor in a really equitable way. And especially thinking about Alyssa as a Native scholar and writer, and me as a non-Native scholar and writer, like what sorts of responsibilities do we want to put on each other? What sorts of responsibilities should I be taking on? How do we want to sort of present the work? And how does the collaboration sort of impact the work that's happening was a big question that we talked about a lot. And it's not, you know, it's a collaboration between Alyssa and I, but it's really a collaboration between us and all of the writers also. Mm-hmm. And I think that, yeah, that was just a really important part of it. To do an anthology, I think, is such a different experience than doing a monograph. And I have to say, I prefer it. It feels like this like multivocal project that doesn't really need to make any comment that's like singular and actually has room for all of these diverse opinions and perspectives but is able to do that in a single object. And I think that was really important to both of us.
Yeah. And they're really hard to do a edited book or an anthology well. And it's such an important work because it highlights so many different voices, like you mentioned.
Yeah. And that was really what we were thinking about was like, a lot of the things that are in the book were previously published in magazines or other sort of literary journals. And part of what we were interested in was saying, there's so much going on out there, really. And there's so much like interesting nonfiction work happening. And what if we can just bring it together in one place and just really have something that's like, it's just like a shot in time kind of what it looks like right now, that would be really useful. And having people be able to access it in one place, you know, we talked a lot about access and thinking about how to get these works in conversation with each other so that people could see that those conversations happening.
Yeah, definitely. And really just breaking open the whole concept of what is already published or what is out, and kind of this, I don't know, like a capitalist narrative of something always wanting to be new or fresh or something. And with the internet and media, people don't always see things that are out. So repackaging or repurposing things and putting them together, reweaving them is so cool. Cause I hadn't seen a lot of these writings either.
Yeah, I love that. I hadn't thought of it that way, like that we were reweaving them into this, you know, and I think that the way that we did it would hopefully, even if people had encountered these essays before, help them see them in different ways, because there's so many facets to the essays that I still teach a lot of the essays when I teach Native and Indigenous Lit, and students get something new from it every time. And so it's really amazing to see, even when these things are brought together, it doesn't mean they're not alive. It doesn't mean they're not still sort of producing different kinds of knowledges just by being in the world. And that's been really exciting to see.
Yeah, I love highlighting contemporary writers as well. I feel that's something that June Jordan does so well, and Felicia Rose Chavez as well always highlights that.
Yeah, I think it's really important, especially for Native literature, when a lot of folks are taught about Native lit or Native people just in the past. Mm-hmm. And this is really a way to emphasize that these are like new and innovative things that Native authors are doing right now, and really counters that narrative about the past and about the future too, you know, and our ideas about who exists in the future.
Definitely. Well, thank you. I'd like to discuss your book, Other Worlds, here. Now,
sure.
Honoring Native women's writing in contemporary anarchist movements. And I just wanted more on the framing of the book. I was maybe misreading it of what you mean when you say new anarchism or anarchism in your book.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you said that the term is referencing kind of new anarchism from the Graeber 1999 mm-hmm. W2 Yale movement into Occupy. And then also along with the term settler anarchism, which you define as a model of anarchist politics that reifies the structure of settlement within its own political philosophy. And I was wondering, mm-hmm. do you see your work as an intervention into so-called U.S. and Canadian white settler anarchism?
Yeah, definitely. That's really what I'm, you know, as a person who grew up in the United States and has lived on the U.S.-Canada border for the past 10 years, and has been, you know, at different times, different amounts of related to the movements that I'm talking about. I think what I'm really interested in is this kind of anarchism that became really more popular in the United States in that sort of, you know, alter globalization or global justice movement time period, with the protests against the WTO being this like really interesting story that is told as the sort of beginning of that form of new anarchism. And what I was really interested in was like not a really sort of simple critique of saying like, well, anarchism has this history, this European history. Like I don't think that's like necessarily this disqualifying thing, but I think we need to think about what happens when it sort of jumps the pond, and how is it different when it becomes, you know, rooted in U.S. politics or in the history of the United States. And that's something that I sort of saw happening with new anarchism, is this way that it's really becoming engaged in not like a U.S. centric necessarily, because it was a very, and still is, I think, a very global movement, but which is really rooted in like thinking about U.S. politics and thinking about U.S. political imagination. And so that I was really interested in that sort of era of anarchism, because it's this era, I think, where there was this like much more intense interest in anarchism, and it really developed into something a little bit different than we'd seen in, you know, the late 19th and early 20th centuries also.
Yeah. And how I see that earlier anarchism being really tied to what you talk about, nationalism and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I have a question later about nationalism, but yeah, how it was really tied to U.S. anarchism was really tied to that. And I saw it as kind of you breaking open with settler anarchism, the whiteness that implies of anarchism in a lot mm-hmm. of scenes. But when I say that, I also don't want to contribute to any erasure of the work
right.
of Black, Indigenous, and all non-white anarchists globally, such as, you know, the Maroon movement in DC and Baltimore, Indigenous
yeah.
Action, who's also part of the Channel Zero Network. And you, yep. as you mentioned in your book, William Anderson and Lorenzo Irving and Jonina Irving and Ashanti Alston. So when we're discussing a lot of these critiques, and also in your book, you're talking about settler anarchism in that
mm-hmm.
moment. Okay.
Yeah. And I can say too, like, that's exactly was my concern as well. Like, that in talking about settler anarchism, like, I don't want to ignore the long histories of anarchisms from communities of color and from indigenous communities. Also, my sort of question about it when I was going into the book was why hasn't this sort of transformed the basis of anarchism in this, like in Occupy, for instance? Like, if there's been so much engagement from indigenous anarchists and Black anarchists, why does the anarchism of Occupy look sort of similar, or why are there some of the same sort of problems with the like approach of Occupy that there were during the alter globalization movement or global justice movement? You know, that, and that's, and that if we want to take seriously the sort of interventions that anarchists of color are making and indigenous anarchists are making, that's going to require a really transformative look at, you know, what anarchism is and what we consider it to be.
Yeah, and I really like the methodology and stuff that you broke into on the Battle of Seattle, or the Battle in Seattle, and these kind of how you went into the canon on this anarchist, quote, anarchist canon, and broke that open, which is so important. I really loved this intervention, and I learned a lot from it. And talking about how other worlds here, quote, emerges from a desire to center a place-based method of engagement in our anarchist inquiries. And you do highlight that your theory does not theorize a new way of understanding place, but broadens the term. And adding on to that, I was wondering if you could speak more about the 1856 Battle of Seattle and how you pivoted in context with how the 1999 WTO battle in Seattle is framed.
Yeah, I mean, this was just a really interesting thing that happened to me while I was like researching the book. And part of what happened when I was doing research for the book, you know, this was originally my dissertation project. And so, but it went through a lot of revision, partly because I moved from where I was doing grad school in Haudenosaunee territory in Buffalo to the Pacific Northwest, where I got a job on Lummi and Coast Salish territory in Bellingham. And so I was sort of, the project had to change a little bit because I was in a different place. And so part of what I was doing with this chapter is, you know, learning about the region and having moved to the Pacific Northwest, learning about the region. And I was doing all of this research about anarchism and noticing that, and especially about new anarchism, and noticing that all of these books usually started with the story of the 1999 battle in Seattle. And that was like this sort of requisite. And I say in the book too, my book also begins with that, right? So it's sort of funny. But then when I was learning about the history of the region, I learned about this Battle of Seattle in 1856, which was part of the what's sometimes called the treaty wars in the area. And at the time, Seattle, you know, was a settlement in Washington Territory. And it was this, it wasn't a huge battle, but it was a battle where I think the usual narrative of it is that it was an attack by Native people upon the settlement of Seattle. And then the sort of settler people were supported by the Marines from the United States Navy. And that was a ship called the Decatur that was anchored in Elliott Bay. And so, and there's a lot of stuff around Seattle that's named after the ship, after Decatur. And it became this really important story for settlers that it was this instance supposedly where they'd been attacked and had to fight back. And so it became this sort of narrative about, you know, the dangers of the frontier and about the sort of victory of settlers in this sort of fight against Native people in the time. And I just was, you know, I thought it was interesting that it had the same name, that like this battle is known as the Battle of Seattle. That's how it's referred to in history books. That's how, you know, if you Google it, if you're looking on Wikipedia, like that's what it's called. And that there was no sort of engagement with that sort of battle in the Battle of Seattle in 1999 was, to me, I was like, they're just on a most basic level. I was like, they're called the same thing. It seems like it might get confusing at some point. But then on a more, I think on a deeper level, it started getting me to think about, well, how did the activism of the 99 battle in Seattle engage with place and engage with the fact that it wasn't a coincidence that happened in Seattle, that those protests happened in Seattle? And what is the sort of history of settlement in the region that is the literal foundation of these protests as well. And how are people engaging with that? And so that, you know, I became more interested in the relationship between those two battles for that reason. Like there's that really basic sense that yes, they're called the same thing, but also one is really part of the reason why Seattle is a city and why Seattle was a place that could have a massive protest like they did in 99.
Yeah. And it highlights like the violence that it took to make Seattle like this.
Right.
And when reading a lot about the 1999 battle in Seattle, sometimes some of the narratives would go back to the IWW fight mm-hmm. and the police attacked them in 1919. And was it Everett? I believe it was Everett.
Mm-hmm.
But I never had seen this connection you make, which is so important. And you bring up this is what happens when a prominent story of radical nativity is told and retold without a commitment to place. And it's really important.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, yeah, that's really what, and part of it is just, like I said, my attempt to sort of get to know place and figure out my place where I was, you know, to figure out what it meant to be an anarchist in, you know, Western Washington in the 2010s when I moved there. Like, what sort of histories was I part of and what sort of, you know, responsibilities did I have then? And so I'm still sort of asking those questions, but that's part of moving to a new place. And it really changed the book for me moving across the country. And so it was a really interesting process for sure.
And you also tied in the McCaw-Whaling controversy in 1999. Mm-hmm. And you had written about how many animal rights and right-wing people aligned to be anti-native when whaling was allowed. And the story about Ben White was involved in the WTO protests and was also going against the macaw whale hunt was really mm-hmm. illuminating as well.
Yeah. I think that Ben White was such an amazing activist, and the work that he did for the 99 protests was so amazing. And I think I even mentioned that the sort of turtle brigade that he was part of, that one of those costumes is now in the Smithsonian as part of like an exhibit about the protests. And so like, it's really sort of that narrative is really central to those protests, but I got sort of turned on to this argument from a colleague of mine named Zoltan Grossman, who is a professor at the Evergreen State College. And he came and saw a presentation that I did about the two battles of Seattle at a conference. And he said, you know, you should look into the macaw whaling controversy, because that's part of what was going on at the time. And there's not a lot of discussion of, you know, how Native people might have been feeling about, you know, activism from non-Native people at the time. And when I found out, you know, that Ben White was part of that group of opposing the macaw whaling controversy, it was just this really interesting like connection that made me think a lot about what was going on in Washington at the time. And that controversy is still very controversial. I mean, Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd just came out with a new book particularly about the macaw whaling controversy. So it's still something that is very just, I think controversial is the best word, but it is not sort of part of the conversation about the WTO protests in a way that I think is really, doesn't really recognize the history of the place or the things that were going on at the time.
Yeah. Thanks for breaking that open. And then you did it when you went to Occupy Wall Street, you pivoted that very nicely with Joanne Barker's mm-hmm. Talking about how Zuccotti Park had left out the Lenape history in large part in a lot of the historians who've written about Occupy haven't talked about this.
Yeah.
And how the whole name of Wall Street was named after a wall built by the Dutch to prevent Lenape people attacking these colonizers in the place. So it's also really important intervention mm-hmm. as well. And a lot that wasn't getting spoken about in a lot of Occupy movements. I know everywhere is different and the history is not so well recorded. Just to give an example, in Denver, in so-called Denver, where I'm from, the homelands of the Cheyenne, Arapaho, and Ute, at the Occupy encampment, AIM was part of it as well.
Mm.
And some movements came and, you know, immediately started talking about the term Occupy as a colonizer term and mm-hmm. something that Columbus did. And Occupy Denver came and had a I think they joined together to acknowledge that it would be a decolonial movement of mm-hmm. Occupy Denver. But yeah, a thing that happened so much that it just became a really problematic term.
Yeah, and I think there are lots of instances like the ones you're talking about that are really exciting, like ways that even from the beginning, people were questioning that use of the term occupy and just thinking about like, what do we want these movements to look like? And I hope that my work doesn't discount some of that activism. I think what I'm concerned with is these sort of overarching narratives. So the way that I'm really interested in how things, stories get retold. And the way that's why I was interested in, you know, the Battle of Seattle in 99, that part of what I was doing was I'm not sort of talking about what happened on the ground as much because there were lots of indigenous people there and there were lots of people, you know, the Indigenous Environmental Network was there and Tom Goldtooth like gave a talk at the WTO protest and there was that kind of involvement. But my sort of interest is in, okay, well, how does that get written into the sort of history that we talk about? And that's like you're mentioning that, you know, the history of Occupy is still being written. And the part of what I'm interested in is, you know, how do we tell that in a really honest way and say, even from the beginning, there was this question about the use of the term Occupy instead of getting into a sort of like a fight, essentially. Like, I'm not trying to fight with anybody. Basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that there's the way that those narratives get told is really interesting to me. And the way that the story gets retold, like the story of Occupy, and we still call it that, you know, and it's still, I just want to make sure that those sort of the conversations that happened, like the one you're talking about in Denver, that becomes part of the narrative. Like mm-hmm. that becomes part of the way that we talk to people who weren't there about what happened. Because I think that's how the sort of institutional memory of it is maintained.
Yeah, and the way that I'm reading your work and critiques is it seems like you're going more after this anarchist canon or anarchist history of way things are being framed. And like you said, that's not the everyday lowercase anarchy that's going on. Mm-hmm. And also your intervention into those canons or more known histories are also an intervention into a form of settler anarchism, because the people who are, quote, seen as the authority of history of these movements, or even the people getting published and recognizing these histories that get studied, usually are being published due to benefiting from white supremacy or whiteness mm-hmm. in a lot of regards.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's how I'm thinking about the work too, is that I want anarchism to be successful. And I want us to, and I, you know, I use us throughout the book. I say I throughout the book. I really include myself in part of in this, you know, body of work that I'm talking about. And what I want is for us to have these difficult conversations about settlements so that we can get to a place where our activism, our scholarship, our organizing is really undoing the structures of the state and capital in like real ways. And the structure of the US state is a little bit different than the structures of European states, the way that, you know, canonical anarchist thinkers were talking about. And we need to be really thoughtful about that in the contemporary moment.
Yeah, thank you. My next question was kind of about the discussion between anti-colonialism and decolonization and how settler anarchism, like many parts of academia, are kind of mm-hmm. falling into using decolonizing a lot. Mm. In your book, you had used the term or the sentence in the context of this chapter that there can be no decolonization within a settler state. I think that's a really important term, and also kind of this nuance that I was kind of trying to talk about. Wondering what if you had thoughts on that, on the word anti-colonialism compared to decolonization and kind of how these are mm-hmm. being watered down.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of complicated feelings about it, partly because I'm in the, you know, a white non-native scholar in the academy doing this work. And that's not, you know, everything of who I am, but that's, you know, what I do on the regular, like that's my job. And so I think a lot about like what decolonization can look like. I think about a lot of the ways that it's been appropriated to be a sort of non-radical approach. And I think of radical in the sense of like really returning to the root of the problem and really transformative. And so the way that, like, to me, something that's decolonial, it can't be decolonial without critiquing the state. Like, it's just not, to me, that's one of the roots of colonization is the creation of the U.S. settler state. And so without a critique of that, I don't see how we can get to a decolonized standpoint. And I think that there's a lot of work that attempts to do that, to sort of rectify. And this is like a more liberal approach, I think, than a radical approach. I have so many feelings about it. Yeah, there just can be no decolonization without that sort of critique of the state and without thinking about the material return of land, the return of material resources. And that just because something is anti-colonial, like is against colonization, doesn't mean that it's necessarily doing the work of undoing that colonization. And I think those, we need to be clear about those two different processes, that there could be a critique of colonization, but we also need to sort of build up something else in its place.
And then I was wondering if you could maybe just break open a little bit more on the thoughts on gender and sexuality, gender binary and hierarchy, and how those are usually brought up, but sometimes it's not parsed with settler colonialism. And I believe you tied this to Mark Rifkin's term, the stability of the given.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of really interesting work coming out of anarchist studies and just anarchist scholarship about gender and sexuality. And it's been, I think, a really great way that anarchism has been transformed in a lot of ways is by like the prevalence of anarchist feminism and thinking about the influence of like radical gender politics on anarchist movements. I think there's a lot of really good, like symbiotic relationships there between those movements. I don't think that there's is exactly like you're saying as much of a connection between the gender dimensions of settlement and that, you know, I think in the book, part of what I was trying to get at was that there are some of the most sort of pertinent issues regarding gender and sexual violence are related to settler colonialism. And settler colonialism is this gendered and sexual process. And it has been since the beginning. And that if we can't see the sort of connections between those things, then we end up not actually addressing the root of the issues. And I think that there's, you know, when we think about some of the stuff that radical gender politics are trying to do, like break open this idea of binaries, not just the gender binary, but just the idea of like how we use binaries as a political or even cultural tool. And I think that's really useful for thinking about settler colonialism as well, you know, thinking about how did this binary, you know, when I teach this, my students are always like, well, how did this happen? is basically their question. Like they just are like so horrified by the fact that this exists by, you know, they're, you don't need to convince them of that sort of aspect of it. But then they're sort of questioning, well, how did this system get set up? And I think colonialism is often one of the ways that I talk about, well, this was a really important part of how the gendered binary became so essential to American politics, to American culture, is because it was really essential to settlement, to things like who's going to own land. You know, that the gender binary was really important to being able to set up a really white supremacist patriarchal structure for land ownership and the theft of native land. And so those things were really, you know, that's just one example of the way that those two things are really deeply connected. And I want us to be able to see those connections so that as we're working towards or working against things like settlement, we can also make sure that we know that gender and sexuality are part of that.
Thank you. Thanks for breaking that open. I really liked the part of where you were breaking open Janet Rogers' critique in honor of Ginsburg's How. And I kind of saw this as a way a lot of critical theory uses, I think the term is creolization, where they may take like Rousseau and Fanon and compare their works and find some good conversations between them. And I felt this was really similar in a way that it doesn't create erasure, but it also calls to to task like those problems with Ginsburg or the Beat Generation. You know, this is just an example. And you had said it reckons with the tension at the heart of other worlds here, how we can honor the formative influence of radical politics while simultaneously addressing the way such politics reproduce the structure of the U.S. settler state.
Yeah.
And I really liked this section. I was wondering if you had any comments or more to add on this topic.
I just love Janet Rogers' work. And I thought this poem, you know, when I was young, Howl was so influential to me, you know, and like, just reading some of those radical beat poets and, you know, people that were sort of counterculture, it was really influential to me to learn about those folks and to think about the idea of there being a counterculture in general as something that is like built up and something that you can be part of. And I was, you know, starting to be part of my own counterculture or countercultural groups and thinking about, you know, what that meant to exist in a society where you were sort of in this weird relationship to it, where you were like working against a lot of the structures of it. And I think what's so interesting about Janet Rogers' poem is that she's both, exactly like you said, acknowledging Ginsburg as a sort of literary ancestor while also critiquing the work at the same time. And I think that is such an act of love in some ways, that's really what I wanted to do on a bigger scale in the book, was to say, like, I am indebted to anarchist politics for everything about basically who I am and the values that I have and the ethics that I have. And that's how I learned how to be a person that, like, I can wake up in the morning and be okay with who I am, is through engaging with these countercultures and through anarchist politics. But so in that sense, that's sort of part of my history. But at the same time, there's also the fact that me knowing that group so well and being part of groups like that enables me to do this sort of loving, I mean, I think of it as a sort of loving critique that is like, hey, how can we do this better? And like, what are the core problems that we see now that we've been in it for this all this time together? And we've built these structures so that we're in it together. How do we like work through that? And I think Janet Rogers' work in general is really trying to do that through poetry and really trying to think about how do we sort of deal with the things that we inherit, knowing that it's not just about saying I disavow myself of any of this history. You know, she doesn't say like, fuck Allen Ginsberg, I'm never going to read him, that's useless. She's like, Howl is important, and she wants to engage with that, but also critique it at the same time. And I think that's a form of this loving critique that is really about, that quote that you said, like holding both things at the same time and being able to live in that sort of contradiction for a little bit.
Yeah. Thanks for breaking that open. Yeah. I know what Bill Hooks had mentioned a lot on critique being a form of love. And yeah, it's so important because it doesn't just go into, well, we found one thing wrong, we're going to erase that, like erasure. Like it's important to build on top of it and have these discussions because things are messy.
Yes.
Yeah. It's important.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that what you're saying about not sort of throwing something out is really important to me. Like it was important to me with the book to say, like, what I'm trying to do is bolster anarchism. What I'm trying to do is make it a more appealing and exciting and useful political model, instead of saying like, you know what, like this is a colonial whatever and we don't want to use it anymore. Like that's not sort of the approach that I've taken. And I think that it's a different kind of critique that's really enabled through anarchist politics. Like I actually think that this kind of critique is at the heart of what anarchism does. Like it's why we have consensus-based decision-making. It's not, you know, if you expected everybody to always agree, why would you need a model that worked out differences? Like you wouldn't need that. And part of what we have is this model where we expect critique and we expect it to be engaged in this way that is about moving the project forward, about moving us forward in productive ways. And I think that's what that's the work I hope the book can do in the world.
Yeah. And that definitely comes through in your book. And I really liked the part where you said, my critique is fundamentally rooted in my belief that anarchism contains within its structures the possibility for such a transformation of, mm-hmm. you know, breaking open anarchist logics and having more of a critique or reflection on land and place. My next question was, you started the chapter on Vine Deloria Jr., saying from an Indian point of view, it's all foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And you had a discussion on nationalism mm-hmm. in here. And the way I had seen it was that in some activist circles, some may say that all nationalism is bad or something. And mm-hmm. your book really showed that this creates a form of erasure in Benedict Anderson's work. And it creates a form of racism. And you had quoted the Haudenosaunee and how they have their nationalism, which was mm-hmm. prior to European modernity. This goes back to 1722, compared to Benedict Anderson had said that the genealogy of nationalisms is not tied only to European modernity, but to the colonial demarcation of North America as the New World. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could speak more about that. I thought that was a really important point.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that I have sort of, it was one of the, this is like some of the oldest part of the book. So some of the book got really rewritten from the dissertation piece, but this was something that was in the dissertation because it was something that living on Haudenosaunee territory and like working with Haudenosaunee people that I realized like it didn't make sense within an anarchist framework because there was so much sort of anti-nationalism and anti-American nationalism, right? Like anti-patriotism. And there was this way that nationalism became synonymous with American nationalism in a way that didn't sort of seem to honor the idea of Native nations as nations that whose concept of nationalism doesn't come from the same roots as the sort of, you know, Treaty of Westphalia, modern state sort of narrative of nationalism that I think some anarchists were working with. And it's not, and what I tried to show in the book too, and in that chapter is that it's not a foregone conclusion what nationalism is in Native studies. Like it's actually a really big conversation and debate about what kind, and, you know, using the plural nationalisms and like, what does Native nationalism or Native nationalisms look like? The part of what I was trying to argue is that we can't even sort of understand that conversation within the framework that we have. And so it's not so much as, you know, it's not, I don't think what I was trying to argue was saying like, oh, this nationalism just predates American nationalism and it's proof that, you know, it was created somewhere else. But to say that actually there are these really complicated discussions about what nationalism looks like that we can't even have in anarchist spaces if we don't acknowledge that there are these other ways of looking at nationalism beyond the nation state. And it's a really big part of, especially being in the Pacific Northwest too, where we have these, a lot of treaties, and recognizing that one of the first things that treaties indicate is that Native nations are nations, they're sovereign nations, that the US government only makes treaties with sovereign nations. And so then that brings up this, I think this really, you know, interesting question for anarchists about how we're going to deal with the fact that nationalism is an important part of a lot of Native sovereignty movements. And how do we deal with that on a level when nationalism has historically in anarchist politics been really frowned upon and been something that, you know, anarchists have said that we're against? Like, how do we deal with that conversation then? I'm not 100% sure. Like that's part of what I would love to open up space to have more of those conversations.
Yeah. That chapter definitely broke open that conversation and it came through with that. And thank you for your answer to my question. It made my question make more sense to me too.
Awesome. Yeah.
I really liked the last chapters on Leslie Marmon Selko. Mm-hmm. And I loved just the interventions that you did and kind of the different readings of Selko's work and your reading of her poem and disrupting settler theories of the Bering Strait mm-hmm. thing that always comes up of migration, discussing writing on turtle shells and Turtle Island, and how you had discussed how Selko brings the Laguna Pueblo and the Yupik to forefront instead of U.S. settler borders. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if you could maybe talk more about this chapter or some things that you really found interesting. You also had went into, believe it looked like, some archive or personal letters as well, and just some things you found surprising or interesting from that.
Yeah, this was a really, it was an interesting chapter to write, and it's a brand new one. So this, whereas the sort of stuff about nationalisms was in the dissertation and was something I was thinking about early, this became something that came in much later to the book. And I think I was looking for a way to end it that dealt with this sort of global question. And I, you know, to be honest with you, I can't remember why I decided to do work. I think why I decided to work in the archives in Leslie Silko's papers. I think it was because I learned that I had gone to Alaska because I had moved to the Pacific Northwest, and all of a sudden Alaska was very close. And so I had gone on a trip to southeastern Alaska, and I brought Ceremony with me because it had been a while since I read it. I'd read it in grad school, but I was thinking about teaching it again. And the edition that I had was a very early edition. And so I was going on this trip. I didn't want to bring this early edition with me, so I bought a new one. And it was this new one that had, and it's the version that I work with a lot in the chapter, that it had this introduction where she talks about having written most of the book in Alaska. And I just thought that that was so interesting that she, because it's such a place-based book, and it's so much about the desert and about Laguna Pueblo and about that area. And I thought, what an interesting, just like little tidbit that she had written this book while, and then in the intro, she talks about how she had written it while in Alaska. And part of what she was doing was that she missed the desert so much that she was trying to like write something that would bring her back there while she was in Alaska. And so that was just so fascinating to me. I just thought, I didn't know that she had spent time in Alaska. I didn't know that she had written this, you know, her most famous book while she was there. And so I went to the archives to sort of look for earlier versions of Ceremony to see if there were any, like if there was any indication there, or to sort of just understand that relationship better, like what had it been like for her to write this while she had spent time in Alaska. And when I got into her archives, I found, actually, I thought what was just a really compelling sense that when she was in Alaska, she was really thinking about the Pacific as a place. And I thought that was just so fascinating, like to see the way that she was making these connections between Alaska and Japan. And then also looking at and being clear about the fact that there were so many different nations, native nations in Alaska, and that she was trying to stage this conversation between not sort of native people and the US government, but between like between native people across these sort of, or indigenous people sort of across the world. Yeah. And it was my first experience doing sort of archival research in somebody's letters, since it was a very intimate, like, experience and very strange in some ways to be reading them. But I found lots of cool things that I ended up using, including like the image that's the sort of epigraph to the book. I found that during my archival research. And yeah, it was just, it made me look at the book in a whole different way. And it was so exciting to see those sort of personal elements of what she does and what she did for that book, because it's such a big, important book. Like if you look at any, if you Google like, you know, most important native literature, like that book is on almost every list. And I wanted to do something different with it. And I was just fascinated by the fact that she had been in Alaska while she was writing it. I don't know if you've been to Southeast Alaska, but the weather is the, like almost the complete opposite of a desert. It just rains constantly.
Oh, wow. No, I never have.
Yeah,
I liked it. I liked the letter you had found.
Yeah.
That you put in the book. That was really cool to read the letter. And then I really like how you mentioned how that while writing Ceremony, she recovered from debilitating headaches.
Mm-hmm.
And that she healed along with the main character, Tayo, and crossed vast space through her literary journey. That was really cool.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that was some of the most fun stuff I work on contemporary literature mostly, as you can tell in the book. And so I don't do a whole lot of archival research, but that was like this very exciting trend for me to just like to just be there with someone's letters is, like I said, it's just very intimate. And to hear, like, to be able to reproduce some of that for the reader to see, like, what she was thinking about at the time and, you know, how she was talking about her time there was really exciting for me.
Cool. Thank you for sharing that story. And then my last question is kind of, what are you working on next? And yeah. Also, like, anarchism and joy, like, what are you seeing that excites you?
Yeah, I mean, I'll start with that one that I work at a college, and I work with mostly, you know, we have a lot of students that are mostly between the ages of 18 and 24, 25. And I've just been seeing, like, during COVID, watching the students sort of show up for each other and develop. I've watched a lot of the students develop mutual aid networks. So we have a couple different mutual aid networks for Western in specific and for Whatcom County students. And watching that has really given me a lot of joy. And seeing the way that young people that I work with are, like, showing up for each other and engaging in these, like, a model of mutual aid that I think, not that we didn't do that when I was young, but I think it's so much more mainstream in a way now that the idea of, like, supporting each other is very common and very central to the sort of social dimensions of what I see my students doing. And it makes me feel like being more supportive in my, like, I can feel my pedagogy changing. I can feel the way that I interact with students changing, that I see ways of being more, yeah, just more supportive of the work that they're doing. And I think that that's really exciting to see all of those, like, these conversations become more mainstream and to see these practices become more mainstream as, like, I don't mean sort of more accepted, but I mean, like, just as a basic good, you know, that people see mutual aid as a basic good, like, that, why wouldn't we do that? I think is a really exciting thing to witness. And I'm sort of thinking now about two different projects. One is, one of the things that I wish that I had done a little bit better in the book was to think critically about the category of woman and women's writing. And, you know, to build on that, I would like my next project to be, I'm working on something about queer Native writing and sort of gender and genre and the way that queer Native writers are really playing with genre as a way of also playing with gender. And so I'm really interested in folks like Billy Ray Belcourt and Leanne Simpson, Ariel Twist, the way that these authors are, and like Jay Simpson, who does performance art as well as poetry, and just thinking about the way that these queer Native creators are refusing the sort of not only gender binary and gender boundaries, but are refusing genre binaries.
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Brian Jefferson, and you were just listening to an episode from December 18, created by the Time Talks podcast. If you want to hear the rest of the show or hear more from these creators, you can head to their website at timetalks.libsyn. Before you go, here's some news that you can use. Health Minister Christian Dubé announced a plan to expand booster shots to all Quebecers by January 21st. The third shot will be available to a new age group every few days, starting with Quebecers aged 55 to 59 on January 4th. You can find a timeline for booster shot authorization on Premier François Legault's Instagram or Facebook. And the McCord Museum has been offering 100 days of free admission as part of its centennial celebration. The promotion ends January 19th. You can book a visit on the museum's website. And it's New Year's Eve. There are light installations throughout the city to celebrate. The 12th edition of the art event Luminotherapy is taking place in the Quartier des Spectacles. You can also take a walk through Old Montreal and see its lit-up streets. Search up Luminaire sur les Vieux Montreal for a map.
Whose data? Our data. When you're not paying for a product, you are the product. Especially in web and email services, where multinationals compete to manage your communication so they can make a profit off of the private communication you are producing. Coombit is a worker cooperative trying to help small organizations or individuals get their email, website creation, and website hosting services off corporate services such as Google. For more information, contact us at Coombit.org or email at info@coombit.org. That's K-O-U-M-B-I-T. We are not on Facebook.
And that concludes another year of the Friday edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Kate Addison, Joel Salmadal, and Sarah Jesmer. From all of us here, thank you for tuning in each week. We look forward to bringing you more news produced by and for the Montreal community in 2022. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support us, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 7000, or newsintern at ckut.ca.
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Bekati guru ka aranai mani ninama inu tumilanga mani tilungi
Hi, ani pisipyo junga ulume March 30, 2021 ammalo nitigo mutunga sugetse ulume janapa me okhali makate khalanga jo tachme nga ingiqtimi Sana Sitinak, Tana Ingisu Ratmik, Amalotina Pisuti, Apetsulanga Mejo Dati Upimit, Amalo Celsi Jun, Nuliam Nanita, Amisuak Terosara, Kakataximalotu, Nitos Jarosing in Nut, Taco Atili Twin Flames, Amalo Inutitu Nichotinitus, Akatranga Mejuzi, Nijajunit, Nara Twin Narati. Hi, I'm Annie Pisuti. Today is March 30, 2021, and welcome to Nipibut. Today, Jennifer May speaks with rapper and musical artist Shana Sitinak, and Tina Pisuti interviews Jaji Upi and Celsi June of award-winning musical group Twin Flames. Also, we will be playing Inuktitut music, so keep on listening.